In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around potential targets such as military bases and chemical plants may be advised to evacuate.
Hello, Sublation Media viewers and readers. It's the Sublation Magazine show. I'm Douglas Lane, author of Batch Bash Revolution and Big Bad Boss here at Sublation.
And I'm Ashley Frawley, and I apologize that we're a little bit late. It's my fault. I had some technical difficulties. I am a sociologist at the University of Kent and an author, and I am number two at, that sounds terrible, at Sublation Media.
You're number one in Star Trek lingo. You're my number one. So, with us today is in that red blot, the abstract art there. That's Chris Cattrone, the last Marxist, author of The Death of the Millennial Left, and an upcoming book from Sublation and entitled, this is, why do I forget, Marx's, what, you tell us, Chris, what's
Marxism
the title?
Marxism in Politics.
Marxism and politics. This is why, you know, it's the word politics that I stumble on. It's like, oh, ugh, politics.
And the subtitle is Essays on Critical Theory and the Party. And I guess we're going to be talking about critical theory.
Yeah, we are. And we're going to be talking about the Frankfurt School. We had decided a few days ago to respond to Midwestern Marxism's, I think rather naive post about the Frankfurt School. I'm not upset with
no. I completely agreed with it, and I challenge both of you to convince me otherwise. I thought it was great. I thought it was a really great clip, really like quick and snappy, and explains what's wrong with the Frankfurt School. So change my mind.
I need a gulag button. Okay. So we'll be having a debate. It turns out I had no idea, but let's start with this. This clip, and Ashley, you can start after by telling people what you like about it. Here we go.
So I recently had a light bulb moment when I was reading the work of two thinkers, the journalist Max Blumenthal and the philosopher Gabriel Rockhill. Now, Rockhill's work has criticized a lot of French philosophers and thinkers from the so-called Frankfurt School who called themselves Marxists. These included people like Theodore Adorno and Max Horkheimer, who Rockhill shows were actually supported and promoted by the CIA and the U.S. State Department. This is because the CIA preferred the Frankfurt School's version of Marxism, which emphasized culture war issues over class struggle. They focused more on gender, sexuality, and identity politics rather than broad working class politics. And the Western ruling class chose to promote this form of Marxism because they saw it as less of a threat to their power and their economic interests. And it's this form of Marxism that's usually taught today in Western colleges, if it's taught at all. Now, Max Blumenthal's book, The Management of Savagery, talks about how the right wing feeds off of this fake left. In the early 2000s, right-wing strategists Steve Bannon and Andrew Breitbart were inspired by a documentary by a guy named William Lind called The Roots of Political Correctness. And this documentary argues that political correctness and so-called wokeism actually stem from Marxism. And guess who they cite in order to make this point? The exact same CIA-backed pseudo-Marxist that Gabriel Rockhill criticizes in his article. So Andrew Breitbart and Steve Bannon created a strategy to organize working people by turning them against political correctness and so-called wokeism and labeling it as Marxism. They argued that because of the Frankfurt School and the French theorists, Marxism had transformed from a philosophy about class struggle into a philosophy about culture wars and political correctness. When in reality, political correctness and identity politics has nothing to do with Marxism. That's the CIA-backed pseudo-Marxism. Orthodox Marxism is just about organizing the working class and overthrowing the capitalist ruling class. So the CIA created a fake version of Marxism that right-wingers like Jordan Peterson and Donald Trump now rail against and attack. And this was kind of epitomized in the Zizek versus Peterson debate. Zizek is one of these pseudo-Marxists who was really influenced by the Frankfurt School. If you go back and watch this debate, he's not really arguing for class struggle or the overthrow of capitalism. He's more of a postmodernist than he is a Marxist in a lot of ways. So yeah, I thought this stuff was really interesting and really helped explain the modern right as well as the modern left. And I wrote an article on this for the Journal of American Socialist Studies 3, which will be released on MidwesternMarx.com fairly soon. Thanks to Gabriel Rockhill and Max Blumenthal for doing such amazing research.
All right. So before we begin, I just want to do what he did, which is hold up my copy of Capital. I too can hold up books I haven't read. Okay, so
I've got all my notes in it.
So Ashley, what did you like about that clip on that TikTok takedown of the Franklin School?
I a formative kind of experience. I'm very disheveled today. I apologize for my appearance, but I thought that I got this. It's so cliched. I'm just a cliche. I'm a mess, and I'm wearing a Che Guevara t-shirt. Anyway, which I got in Cuba, by the way. So anyway, okay. What I liked about this particular clip, this was formative to me. The rejection of the Frankfurt School was core to my finding Marx. So I think that he was absolutely right that you get this version of Marxism that is a bastardization even of the Frankfurt School. But in high school, you know, I remember I used to teach A-level sociology in the UK, and I walked into the classroom and up on the wall, it was like all the anti-consumerist stuff. Does Coca-Cola really make you happy? And that was like, you know, you got like quite a complex theory, and it passes through a million different filters. And what comes out at the end is like, don't buy Coca-Cola because it doesn't really make you happy, kind of garbage and nonsense. Which, to be fair, like isn't the fault of the Frankfurt School, but that is what is taught at the lower levels. And you go up and you kind of get this this version of Marxism that is very much cultural, that is tends to be quite anti-mass society. It has a very elitist ring. So when you learn about it, you're like, oh, you're getting this special information. You're not going to be duped into supporting capitalism by consuming too much. And these are the conclusions that you're kind of invited to draw, which bear very, very little resemblance to what Marx actually wrote. So when I came out of university, I had learned Marxism as essentially the Frankfurt School. I had zero understanding of political economy. You know, I had taken classes called the Sociology of Cultural Forms, which was all Frankfurt School. I was only vaguely aware that capitalism might have something to do. I don't know. Maybe Marxism might have something to do with economics if it's a critique of capitalism. And of course, this is a critique of myself as a, you know, I was a kid, right? I finished university and I was like 20, 21 years old. It was reading Marx in the original. We'll do a stream for the 10th anniversary of Diet Soap soon on April 16th, where Doug and I go into this a little bit more detail. I've lost my train of thought there. I'm sorry.
Well, can I jump in and say something about the? Go ahead, yeah. Okay, just briefly, there is a strain of what becomes anti-consumerism in the Frankfurt School, but it is grounded in a critique of political economy, which you can yourself critique if you like. I actually created a video years ago about consumerism, defending consumerism, really, and mentioned Adorno's critique of bikinis, is how I remember it, in the video. But I think the point that of disagreement I have with Adorno and Pollock and Horkheimer is nuanced, and it's I'm not even 100% sure that I'm correct from my perspective, but it's very far away from the kind of critique that we just heard from Midwestern Marxism. Adorno was not claiming that, oh, the problem was workers have too many goods, and that the problem is they're fat and happy or anything like that. And he was not anti-consumerist in the way that like Zizek would critique later on. Rather, he had a critique of the way that the commodity exchange, the dominance of the market, emptied content out of our lived experience and of our consumption, which deserves a hearing on its own, and which is being
Can I just say something, Doug, about this?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead,
so,
Chris.
So similarly to what Ashley said, I was first introduced to the Frankfurt School in college in a kind of media studies context. And it was Benjamin and Adorno, and it was the Benjamin Adorno debate. And Benjamin was falsely enlisted as like defending or even promoting popular culture and proletarian art. And Adorno was seen as the defender and promoter of like high art, high culture. Of course, that's all wrong. I mean, what you were getting into, you know, it gets a little bit more complicated. Meaning, you know, it's not about the market. It's not about the commodification of culture, because I think that that's where the 80s cultural studies people were hung up, that Adorno was somehow against the commodification of culture and defending high culture against its commodification, whereas the left, right, my professors were kind of defending popular culture. They were saying, okay, popular culture is good because it's the working class's own culture. I don't think that it's about that at all. It's more about our experience of things like time and space. You know, it's really based on Lukács, the idea that capitalism, you know, annihilates time and space. And in so doing, it sort of rips the rug out from under our subjectivity, right? So we have a crisis of subjectivity, and that this is related to the struggle for socialism, insofar as the struggle for socialism is based on a kind of bourgeois subjectivity that's in crisis and is being undermined by capitalism. So it's the workers sort of trying to reconstitute their bourgeois subjectivity, but being given this kind of ersatz bourgeois subjectivity through capitalism and being aware of that. So they, you know, he definitely, Adorno and Benjamin, thought that the working class could be aware of this. Otherwise, there'd be no point in writing these things, right? And even though their work seems to be extremely abstruse, it's pitched to an already existing, you know, constituted working class movement for socialism. I like to point out Krakauer, Siegfried Krakauer, Adorno's mentor in Kant's Critique of Pure Reason when Kant was in high school. He's also enlisted as like a pro-popular culture guy. It's a collection of his writings called The Mass Ornament. I teach this stuff. And he was writing for the Sunday culture section of the weekly newspaper, of the most high circulating liberal newspaper in Frankfurt in the 1920s. So they thought that their ideas could be understood by, you know, something approaching a mass audience. Certainly they thought that their ideas could be understood by people who were already part of the socialist and communist movement of the time.
Right. Can I just say
what the point that I was trying to make there was, where I was going with that? It was the abandonment of political economy that annoyed me, that when I actually went, when I, you know, back in 2007, 2008, I started reading Marx. I started reading, I don't remember where I started. Probably, I think I started with Wage, Labor, and Capital and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did capital reading groups. And I was like, it's about, you know, where's political economy? You know, once it filters down through all these different levels, there's no political economy left. And then when I became a big fan of Grossman, I was really annoyed by the story of how the Frankfurt School had suppressed Grossman's work.
Well, okay, can I just say that let's put the Grossman-Pollock thing to the side for just a moment, because I want to say, even if you disagree with Pollock's interpretation of Marx, it is not the case that the Frankfurt School completely abandoned a critique of political economy in that, by making that move.
I'll also say one more thing about them, which is that, you know, the Frankfurt School, what they did in the 1920s and 30s, and in the 1930s in particular, they are the German correspondence with the Marx Engels Institute in Moscow in the Soviet Union. And so they were chosen as the go-between between the SPD's archive of Marx and Engels's writings and the Soviet Union. And one thing that is extremely influential for the Frankfurt School is the discovery and publication of the Grundrisse. That's really central to them. They're among the very first people to take the Grundrisse seriously. So it certainly isn't a matter of suppressing political economy. And also a lot of, I'm a Frankfurt School scholar. I've read about all this stuff in sort of agonizing detail. People's discontents with the Frankfurt School, the frustrations of the Frankfurt School tend to get attached to these interpersonal conflicts that took place among various members, including the supposed dissing of Grossmann, right? We have to take this kind of narrative with a grain of salt. Meaning that there's usually a malicious intent when people bring up, oh, see, this is evidence of their rottenness. Look at how they treated Grossmann. They even say that about Benjamin. They said, oh, Benjamin died because they didn't give him enough money to get out of Europe in time. No, like this is all just malicious slander. There's so much of this malicious slander, and it comes from the 60s bitterness around the Frankfurt School, but also the post-World War II, the Stalinist bitterness around the Frankfurt School, because a good number of the people in and around the Frankfurt School, in a sense, chose the East rather than the West, meaning after the war, they went back to East Germany and Eastern Europe rather than going back to or staying in the West, where they had been in exile in the Nazi period. So there's a lot of kind of overheated significance given to things. We need to, with this much historical distance, we need to step back and look more coolly at their debates and try to get at what was at stake and not just sort of take sides, right? To sort of say, okay, was there a point in this dispute? Was there a point in Horkheimer and Adorno's critique of Grossmann or not?
Right? Well, I am very comfortable and very practiced at defending Slavoj Žižek from his critics, despite the fact that I often have my own critiques of Žižek. Mm-hmm. But it's really important that if you're going to critique someone that you do so fairly. And I think that's the first thing we should stand on with the Frankfurt School. I think that with Grossmann and Pollock and the debate around how to interpret Marx's critique of political economy that did happen within the Frankfurt School, mm-hmm. in which Pollock appears to have won, I think we could step back and at least attempt to see who had the better argument. And I've done that once, and I thought Grossmann did, although I didn't fully agree with Grossmann's interpretation either. But that is a point to the side of the mischaracterizations of the Frankfurt School overall, I think. Like you mm-hmm. you can't pick that one detail up and say, I disagree with them on this. Therefore, I'm going to throw
it's an argument within
project.
Marxism.
Right.
It's definitely an argument within Marxism, and they definitely agreed more than they disagreed. They definitely... the way that I always like to put it with these longstanding debates in Marxism from the past, those people agreed with each other much more than they agree with us.
That's undoubtedly true. But let me, I want to read you a quote from Rockhill, the one of the thinkers that this dude from Midwestern Marxism mentions is Gabriel Rockhill as an influence, along with Max Blumenthal. And Gabriel Rockhill wrote The CIA and the Frankfurt School's Anti-Communism 2 years ago in June. And I wanted to just say one line from it. He says of the Frankfurt School, their generalized critique of domination is part of a larger embrace of an anti-party and anti-state ideology. And I wanted to point out something that Rockhill's doing maybe unconsciously here, which is that he's conflating the party with the state. Parties are not synonymous with the state. That's even right. In the United States, capitalist parties are civil society institutions with full rights against the state.
Right.
This is why the Democratic Party can run its own primaries as it sees fit. It has no particular obligation to operate
also in the Leninist conception of the party. So this is something I'll plug my book. Mm-hmm. I'll be able to plug my book a few times in this conversation. Mm-hmm. So my Lenin's liberalism is about this, that Lenin was opposed to the statification of the party or the partification of the state in mm-hmm. the Soviet Union. He thought that, and also he thought that the working class should maintain its own organizations independent of both the state and the party.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's this move here in Rockhill to just pretend as though you know, the whoever has state power is the party, and I think that that should be underscored. And I actually quoted you to refute this too. I took a quote from your piece, Horkheimer, 1943, on Party and Class, which I think is in Marxism and Politics. And in it, you wrote, "The role of the political party, specifically as non-identical with workers' consciousness, both individually and collectively, was to actually preserve the individuality of workers, as well as of intellectuals. That is otherwise liquidated in the corporate collectives of capitalist firms, labor unions, and nation states." These rackets, the rackets of the capitalist firms, labor unions, and nation states, have replaced the world party of proletarian socialist revolution, which was itself a dialectical expression of the totality of market relations and of the otherwise chaotic disorder of the concrete conditions of the workers. For Horkheimer, workers related to the political party individually and only as such constituted themselves as part of a class and revolutionary political struggle to overcome capitalism through socialism. It was not that Lenin's party caused the liquidation of the individual, but the latter travesty of Leninism in Stalinism was the effect of a broader and deeper socially regressive history of capitalism, what Marx called Bonapartism in the 19th century, that the 20th century authoritarian state and its concomitant sociological problem of political atomization expressed. So I just wanted to quote you to yourself, Chris.
Excellent. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Right. Do you want to like unpack that for people who might not have
that? Yeah. So look, domination. I mean, there's so many things that people get upset at the Frankfurt School about. And so I'll just say something because I invoked Lukács. People don't like Lukács either. They don't like the early Lukács. They might like the later Lukács who had reconciled with Stalinism. They don't like the early Lukács. What do they say about that? They say he's Weberian. He's a follower of Max Weber. And that's where this theory of domination comes from, that this is Weberian Marxism, or it's really Weberianism and not Marxism. And so I wanted to highlight that, because when someone like Rockhill says, oh, well, the Frankfurt School is hostile to the party and hostile to the state, they probably are thinking that this is the Weberianism. This is like Max Weber and Max Weber's colleague and student, Robert Michels, who wrote the famous book on political parties that was a critique of the SPD before World War I. In which he talked about oligarchy. He basically said, look, this is not, you know, it's a social democracy in favor of the working class. This actually isn't a democratic formation for the working class. This is an oligarchical formation. And so this is seen as like a Cold War liberal attack on Marxism that the Frankfurt School has imbibed and is promoting. So there is a whole elaborate apparatus behind this kind of attack on the Frankfurt School that we should be aware of. They're basically assimilated to a Cold War liberal anti-Marxism and anti-socialism. And no, I mean, in fact, I always like to point out, by the way, I mean, standing apart from the question of the meaning of Marx's critique of political economy, like Pollock versus Grossmann, Pollock is usually, Friedrich Pollock, a very close friend, actually a much closer friend to Horkheimer than Adorno was. He's usually known as the state capitalist thesis guy, right? And what's usually missed in that article on state capitalism, its possibilities and limitations by Pollock, is that it's actually a critique of the theory of state capitalism. It's not like promoting a theory of state capitalism. It's critiquing the theory of state capitalism, which was coming up in the 1930s in this kind of what would, after World War II, become Cold War liberal milieu, right? So this kind of fellow traveler milieu that became very anti-communist, especially around the Hitler-Stalin pact. And so Pollock was critiquing that, but then this is seen as, oh, no, see, the Frankfurt School is adopting this viewpoint. No, it's far more complicated than that, meaning that they have to deal with why it would be plausible, like why is this theory of state capitalism and this kind of critique of Marxism, you know, like James Burnham, the managerial revolution, why does this seem more plausible than Marxism in this time, right? So in other words, to get it, the kernel of truth in it, we might say. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because they didn't actually think that the state had overcome the market, or that somehow the contradiction of capitalism had been eliminated. They thought that actually what had happened was the state had taken on the contradiction of capitalism that previously had been expressed in the market. So in the 20th century, with the kind of mass political, more state-managed, Bonapartist form of capitalism, the contradiction remained, but it seemed more obscure than the contradiction in the 19th century, which seemed to be the contradiction between the market, the chaos, and the socialization of production. Right. So they're saying, right, no, it still is. And that's why atomization, you know, I use that language, which again, this is kind of non-Marxist language, but the chaos now is not in like market mediation, but more in atomization and things like that.
Yeah. But in the 70s and then again in 2008 and in the 80s as well, there are these moments where the crisis appears directly in the market, whether it's mm-hmm. the financial market or mm-hmm. so. It, even if you understand, and I think I understand what you're saying, that the theory of state capitalism was a theory about how the contradictions within capitalism had moved into the state and would take a political form mm-hmm. rather than a purely market form, it turned out that they overestimated
yes.
the degree to which the state could
absolutely
contain.
Absolutely. And the tricky thing for us is that we tend to think of, like, I don't know, economics as objective and politics as subjective.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just as easily say the opposite, that economics is subjective and politics is objective, meaning that we're kind of locked within these political forms. And I think that that's where, like, the Cold War liberalism comes in, because it's really about Cold War liberalism is very pessimistic about politics,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, they are saying, oh, well, you know, the replacement of this kind of economic class struggle by a political struggle actually hasn't made us less alienated or less dominated. But now we're dominated by these political forms that are kind of unconsciously being reproduced. Right. And so that's where, you know, Stalinism and fascism and New Deal, like liberal reformed capitalism, are all seen as, again, approaching a convergence in that the alienation is moving from civil society to the state.
So I want to ask a more abstract and therefore easier to access question. Which is, to what degree do you think the Frankfurt School really is responsible for woke critical theory as we understand it today? For like the, you know.
Well, you know who the villain is for that? That's Marcuse. It's mm-hmm. less Adorno than it is Marcuse. Meaning that Marcuse, actually, interestingly enough, Marcuse is more pessimistic than Adorno in the 60s. So it's usually seen as Marcuse's embracing the new social movements, whereas Adorno is rejecting them. No, Marcuse is embracing the new social movements insofar as he's becoming more pessimistic about the working class. And he's writing things like The End of Utopia, where he says, well, if socialism means the like supremacy of the metropolitan advanced capitalist country working class, that would be horrible because it would even more ruthlessly subordinate the third world. Right. So he's getting very pessimistic. And, you know, in a way that, you know, like Murray Bookchin in Listen Marxist, you know, he's critiquing Stalinism, but he's also critiquing what he calls the neo-Marxism of Marcuse and the pessimism of Marcuse. Meaning that you could have world socialism that isn't just about exploiting the third world or about trying to impose a kind of Western way of life on the third world, etc., that it could be differentiated. And that's where, you know, again, Marcuse is usually seen as saying, well, the revolutionary subject is no longer the traditional working class, but is now like women and minorities and sort of misfits, more generally nonconformists, the counterculture, you know, perverse sexuality. It's Marcuse who really articulates that in a way that Adorno was far more cautious about, right? So when Adorno wrote about, like, I don't know, gay rights struggles in the 60s, he was like, we should support them without giving in to their own narcissistic belief that somehow homosexuality is superior to heterosexuality. Mm-hmm. Right? Whereas mm-hmm. Marcuse would say, actually, in this historical conjuncture, maybe the perverse are superior to the straights.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this came up before we even started the stream. One of our regular viewers and Patreon supporters, Kushluk, was saying that I'm going to see if I can put it on the screen here. It was very early, but something along the lines of, here it is. Here, the grotesqueries of the Frankfurt School laid ever more bare.
I guess Kushluk is like really concerned about like gays or something. Like, I'm a gay.
Yeah.
And so he's saying the Frankfurt School's homophobic. Yeah. No, they're Freudian. And, you know, if you believe Freud is homophobic, then I guess they're homophobic. But Freud also didn't want to cure gays of their homosexuality either. He didn't want to cure any perversions. And, you know, just to observe that sadomasochism, aggression, projective identification, narcissism has a homosexual dimension. They're not talking about like adult perverts. They're talking about the homosexual character of pre-Oedipal psychology. They're not, you know, and let's not forget, there was like a homosexual brigade into the Nazis, right? The brown shirts who were suppressed. And, you know, in other words, it's sort of inarguable that whether overtly or covertly, the kind of mass conformism of the 20th century has a quote unquote homosexual dimension to it.
I would just point out that in the early 20th century, late 19th century, I believe, but I think it was certainly in the early 20th century, the term heterosexual pointed to a paraphilia or a perversion.
Uh-huh. You mean being too attached to the opposite sex?
Yeah, being too caught up in.
Doug, you love to bring this up. You're like, I'm a pervert too. Right. I like pussy. I'm a pervert too.
That's right. Yeah. But no, I pointed out not just to say that, not just to be a troll, but also to note that the idea that individuals could be directed in their romantic and familial life by their sexual desire in any way was a kind of perversion, or, you know, that was not the norm. You know, that was, am I overstating it?
No, I mean, I think that that's right. In other words, they had a different relationship to sexuality and personal identity attached to sexuality back then than we do now. Like, it's actually hard for us to relate to the sexuality of the 19th century. It is, mm-hmm. the psychology is different. And so not to hold it up as some kind of alternative, but just to recall, just to specify, to recognize the specificity of our experience of these things today, which we should not naturalize or take for granted. Now, see that Kushluk is accusing me of amplifying the homophobia of the left. Look, obviously the left historically in the 20th century, the left that we're concerned with, the Stalinist left, was homophobic. And
oh, I think it's now as well, you know, with their obsession now, with trans and all of that.
Generally, oh, sure, the trans stuff does have, I would say, not a homophobic, I mean, it does, but I would say it has more of an anti-sex character, right? So that's where I would sort of locate it. I would say, you know, there's a kind of a weirdness about sex, and that that must necessarily be a kind of anti-gay, right? You know, so I think that that's what we're dealing with. I mean, I would say, look, the left, quote unquote, but society goes through different changes and there are reversals. I always like to bring up Juliet Mitchell, that we always imagine that liberation is the opposite of the status quo. It isn't, mm-hmm. right? I mean, at a very basic level, that's undialectical, meaning that what we have to be aware of is why the left, Stalinists, Marxists, would have been homophobic in the mid-20th century, why they would have seen perversion as bourgeois decadence and as part of the overall oppressive condition of society and the working class in particular. Why was that plausible? Especially because they had a much more libertine attitude about these things previously. Like in the late 19th and early 20th century, they had a much more libertine attitude. Why did the Marxist left become prudish in the 20th century? I mean, a lot of it is conditions in the Soviet Union and China, where they did adapt to the conservatism of society. But this was also taken up in the West, right? The communist movement throughout the world adopted the same kind of homophobia. And again, just to defend Adorno and to defend Freud, homophobia is no less quote unquote homosexual than homosexuality itself is, meaning homophobia is about repressed homosexuality. So that kind of conformism, right, that we're talking about, this mid-20th century domination, you know, like political conformism, social conformism, has an underlying homosexual character, meaning it lacks a toleration for difference. That's what that means, right? When Freud says that, like, I don't know, neuroses have a homosexual character, what he means is that these are people who are having a hard time dealing with difference, right? Who are stuck in a kind of pre-Oedipal, kind of narcissistic projective identification. They're really having a difficulty with difference. And so heterosexuals are in that sense homosexual as well, right? Can you actually accept the other as different from you? Or are they just a narcissistic extension of you? And the popular culture is full of this. Right, we can't deny that popular culture feeds off this. It's also the source of a lot of misogyny in the culture, right? So, and misandry, you know, we can't leave out misandry, right? Meaning, you know, Me Too, I'll never forget, you know, some liberal, I forget his name now, wrote a very passionate essay about how we have to accept the inherent monstrosity of male sexuality.
And I just, no, we don't.
Yeah, absolutely not. Like, this is, we have to reckon with it. Like, we have to sort of acknowledge it and feel guilty about it, right? It's like a version of, like, you know, white people's inherent racism or something, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the kind of thing. I mean, look, so it's not just the homophobia of the left. It is the conformism of the left, right? And it's part of the larger society. It is. Precisely when it thinks it's rejecting it.
There's that conformity, but then there's also the left is also associated with the anything goes kind of, you know, let's have a throuple, abolish the family, that sort of thing. So, I mean, we've got that going on. I don't know how you square that.
Oh, well, because there's a subculture for you to join, right? Right, you're a polyamorous person, right? So you conform to that instead, right? Every subculture has its own conformist imposition that one submits to.
Since we were kind of looking at the comments, there was a comment ages ago that I was burning to respond to, which was from Reed, when I had mentioned that people like Alan Freeman accused the Frankfurt School of suppressing important works of political economy like Grossman's. And he said something like, forgive me, Reed, I can't remember your exact words because the comment's gone now, but it was something like political economy can't of its own bring about a revolution or something like that. I'm sorry. I can't quite remember if it was like brings about a class analysis or revolution. But the thing is, political economy does contain, at least, you know, Alan Freeman makes this argument in a 2018 chapter in one of these Oxford handbooks of Marx. And he says that that what we wound up with is a Marxism without economics and an economics without Marxism, that's kind of the position that we're in today. Whereas he argues what Marx was trying to do was look at the law of value in the sense of a kind of social reproduction or the reproduction of society. And he points out, of course, that Marx didn't use the phrase labor theory of value, that Kautsky coined that, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, that he's talking about that Marx is talking about how each class obtains the value that it needs to reproduce itself, and how this then creates these relations with, you know, the relations among classes, and from which you can then have your analysis of, you know, war and imperialism and all that sort
way
of stuff.
Way too so concrete.
There is a relationship, Freeman says, between political economy and class, and he sort of blames the Frankfurt School for obscuring that. And I don't remember if he goes into this in the chapter, but I know that Neil Davenport, in a 2009 article, which I really like, and which also immunized me against the Frankfurt School, called Dialectic of Anti-Enlightenment, where Davenport accuses Adorno of abandoning the working class because all of the revolutionary Marxist organizations at the time were attributing to it a subjectivity that it didn't possess. And that Adorno was really basically sort of skeptical of this. And it became, the Frankfurt School in general came to stand for a critique of the working class and its subjectivity, which then filters down into the culture, where being on the left becomes about a critiquing the working class and their habits and their behaviors, and sort of laying the blame for the failure of revolution at the feet of the working class. It also leads to a kind of abandonment of a class analysis, except maybe superficially, or you have to sort of redefine class to mean all these other different things. But I don't know, how would you respond to that charge that Adorno lacked this faith in the working class, and this then is responsible for what happened. And also, I'm defending myself against the charge of political economy doesn't that lead in these directions.
Okay, well, it depends on what the value, if you will, of the critique of political economy is understood to be. Meaning, look, Marxism, I mean, again, I'll plug my book again, because this is a theme throughout it. Marxism came out of the critique of the workers' movement for socialism. So the critique of political economy is a critique of the working class's own consciousness in its struggle for socialism, right? So it is about the workers, the proletarian socialist movement of the 19th century, their political economy, their view of society, their view of capitalism, and their view of their own struggle to overcome capitalism is what Marx is critiquing in Das Kapital. That is the entire point of it. So it is a critique of the working class, absolutely. While it's also endorsing the working class's struggle. So it's an imminent critique of the working class's struggle for socialism. That's the entire point. It's not an imminent critique to just bourgeois society in general. It's who believes in bourgeois political economy in the 19th century? The capitalists certainly don't. Who believes in the labor theory of value in the 19th century? The working class. Right? So Marx is critiquing the labor theory of value, which means that he has to accept the reality of it in order to critique it. Like, you can't just say, oh, well, that's just wrong. That's just incorrect. That's just inaccurate. That's empirically false. No, he's taking it up as ideology, as bourgeois ideology. And the only people in this society that actually have bourgeois ideology are the workers. The capitalists certainly don't. The capitalists are doing whatever they're doing, like late stage Roman Empire decadence. You know, they're fiddling while Rome burns. You know, they're Nero, they're Caligula, right? They are not bourgeois. Like, the capitalist class are not bourgeois whatsoever. So the only people with bourgeois consciousness in capitalism are the working class themselves, especially in their struggle for socialism, because they're struggling for the value of their labor, meaning they're struggling for the concrete social value of their participation in production in society. Mm-hmm. That is where the struggle for socialism comes from. It's why we get lost today. Why, you know, I was watching this morning, Carlos Garrido, with Haas on Infrared, you know, MAGA communism. Why would MAGA communism be at all plausible? Well, because clearly capitalism is this extreme decadence of society. And so when society seems to rise up and revolt against capitalism, it does seem like, well, isn't this where we should be? Isn't this what Marxists should take the side of? Yes, at a very basic level, that's true. But of course, we have to go beyond that. Otherwise, we will be with Haas's like proletarian being and, you know, that kind of thing. So the positive value of the working class, Marx could take for granted. Today, as Adorno put it, trying to find it is like trying to look at a picture puzzle. Right? Like, where is the working class? Who is the working class? Do you remember all the debates about where was Trump or Brexit actually supported by the working class? Or was it supported by the petty bourgeoisie and not the working class? Remember those debates from a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the basic point is that we don't have the working class struggling for socialism today. And that means that we are unmoored. Like when we pick up Marx, we're unmoored from his actual object of critique. We might pick up Marx and think he's talking about like capitalism. He is, but his understanding of capitalism was that capitalism came about as a result of the working class's own struggle. You know, that it was an engine of industrialization in the 19th century. This is what where the Frankfurt School are going. You know, why they seem so extremely pessimistic. Because they're like, well, this 20th century capitalism seems to be the result of the working class's own struggle for socialism. And yet it's been channeled into this monstrous phenomenon, the administrative state. And let's not forget, you know, that actually a lot of people do think that socialism is statism. They do think that it's like the welfare state. They do, you know, the millennial left definitely got on board with a kind of neo-social democracy. And that's what, in other words, they're nostalgic for exactly what the Frankfurt School is critiquing. And that's why the Frankfurt School critique kind of, I don't know, is resuscitated in order to be killed again, right? It's like, you know, because you do have to wonder, why is this attack on the Frankfurt School happening? Does anyone care about the Frankfurt School?
Just sublation, I think, at this point. I'm not sure.
What do you mean? Does anyone? Do you mean anyone on the left care about the Frankfurt School?
Yeah, they care enough to attack it.
Well, this is the argument that Midwestern Marx is making, that the Frankfurt School has become a stand-in for Marxism. So when right-wingers want to say, hey, this thing that's right everywhere now, you know, it's actually Marxism. And then this becomes a way of turning the workers against Marx. Cultural criticism kind of, and criticism of everyday life is a criticism of them becomes right associated with Marx.
I mean, I was hoping that we were free of the 60s, meaning that, you know, anti-consumerism, I mean, obviously it's still there in the climate change stuff, you know, the degrowth stuff, the neo-Malthusianism, the critique of consumption. But, you know, so the 60s obviously was very bent out of shape about the working class. They kind of did blame, like the 60s New Left kind of did blame the working class for everything until they rediscovered it in the 70s because of the downturn. Then they were like, oh, white people can be proletarians too, suddenly. It's like, yeah, no shit. So again, I think that we have several phases of history that are being kind of superimposed on each other. We have the sort of 30s moment, you know, the fascist moment and the high Stalinist moment. And then we have the 60s, the countercultural moment. And then we have the more recent period of the crisis of capitalism in the new millennium. And I think that, okay, so you're saying that the reason that the Frankfurt School has to be attacked is that somehow the right wing is going to pin the left with the Frankfurt School, and the way that you have to argue against the right is to say, no, we're not that. We're not the Frankfurt School.
Yeah, that's the opposite of how I feel. I feel it works like this. There is the left, which includes Heideggerians. It includes all sorts of different critical theorists. It includes Ta-Nehisi Coates, and it includes the Hillary Clinton. And then there's the Frankfurt School, which is taught amongst these other kinds of theorists as critical theory in the university. And the Frankfurt School is the closest thing to Marxism you're going to encounter in the university. And the reason it's being targeted is precisely for that reason. It's not because it leads to Hillary Clinton or what have you. It's because reading it could conceivably make you critical of all the rest of the kinds of critical theory that you encounter. That's like, you know, it's post-structuralism and warmed over Heideggerianism. And I made a video about this back when I was at Zero Books, where I went into my public library and took out the philosophy books that were in there. And there were things like Everything I Ever Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, How to Get in Touch with Your Chakras. It was all in the philosophy section of my library. Right. And I was like, we've allowed critical theory to be polluted the way this shelf in my library has been polluted. You know, the Western philosophy, you know, the Socrates and Kant or Plato and Kant, whatever. The Western philosophy had a little tiny shelf, and it was surrounded by all this metaphysical new age self-help stuff. That's basically what's happened to critical theory as well, I think.
Oh, it's become a neurasthenic for the intellectual kids. It's a way that they can make sense of their personal existential angst. No, that's really unfortunate. I mean, so we got to think about it. Okay, so there are a couple of different levels to this, right? So obviously academia, although I think the Frankfurt School is going out of style to a certain extent, meaning that the Frankfurt School is maybe most sort of hip with our generation, Doug, I think.
I was going to say it was out of style by the time I was in university as an undergraduate. Like, even though that's what I was taught, I remember reading someone was like, these ideas are, you know, in a textbook, these ideas no longer enjoy very much purchase. And I had put that in an essay, and my lecturer, who must have been about your age, was like, oh, hold on. Wait a second. I had taken it just at face value. I was just a kid, right? And I was like, no one anymore believes in the Frankfurt School. And she's like, excuse me.
I mean, look, I read
that in a textbook, something like that.
Of course. So here's the danger. First of all, so it's critical theory, capital C, capital T, critical theory, right? Which should tell us something, which is that it's a critique. Meaning it's not giving us like a positive description or a positive analysis. Like, you don't get there to get like a story, like a kind of a narrative of the way things are. You don't. You go to it to get a critique. So this is the problem. And it goes all the way back to Marx. In other words, if you pick up Das Kapital in order to get a description of capitalism, you're missing the point immediately. Right? So firstly, there is an object of critique. It is a critique. We need to know what the object of critique is. Otherwise, we're just completely spiraling and we don't know what they're talking about. Meaning, if you pick up Marx's Das Kapital in order to get a leftist description of capitalism, you really are missing the point, because what Marx is doing, he's critiquing the leftist description of capitalism. That's the point. His object of critique is the leftist description of capitalism. So Marx can't stand in for that, right? This is how it gets very deranged. So Marxism is negative, it's critical, it has an object of critique, it's not a positive description. It's not like, do I agree with this description of reality, or do I agree with some other description of reality, the liberal or the right-wing description of reality? Because I always tell my students, whether academically or in Platypus, look, the other descriptions of reality are going to be a lot more compelling than what you're going to get from Marxism. With Marxism, you're going to get a rather thin gruel, if you know that term. Thin gruel. So that's like a very diluted soup that can barely sustain you. So it's a very thin gruel. It's going to leave you very unsatisfied. You're going to get a much richer and more accurate, more empirically grounded description of reality from anything else. From Marxism, you're going to get some strange, like, abstractions and dialectical turns of phrases and ironies that you're just like, I don't even know what this means. That's what you're going to get. And that's true of the Frankfurt School. It's true of Marx, Das Kapital. It's true of the Frankfurt School, too. So, you know, that kind of positivism, which the Frankfurt School really hated, you know, they've been assimilated to it. You know, if you want to, you know, sort of trip out on metaphysics, you're going to be a lot more satisfied by Heidegger than you are by the Frankfurt School or by Deleuze. You know, you're even going to, you know, you're going to be more satisfied by Foucault's description of like biopower and power knowledge discourse than you are from the Frankfurt School's theory of domination, if you will. Their critical theory of domination is going to leave you feeling like, okay, I don't know what this means or what I'm supposed to do with it.
I want to point out something that, okay, this person, Roxy Sala, says Midwestern Marxist point is that the Frankfurt School targets cultural issues as the object of critique instead of economic issues. And I want to point out, like, if you read Rockhill, his critique of the Frankfurt School, what does he quote in there? He quotes this piece, I forget the name of it, of course, that is about working through the consequence of World War II.
Oh, the meaning of working through the past.
Right. And it is, so to say that that is a cultural critique is to reduce two world wars and the social struggle for socialism that animated and was in the background of those wars to
It's really strange because that culture. Essay in particular is not about culture at all. It's all about politics.
Right. That's right. And you can, even when they are talking about culture, they're talking about the political effect of the culture and the you know,
or the cultural effect of politics, really, because they tended to see like Hollywood as just like shameless capitalist political propaganda.
But that's the point, right? Like that becomes where the battle is,
right?
That it's about critiquing Hollywood as shameless propaganda, and the masses are duped. The masses were duped by the Third Reich, and the masses are duped by consumerism, and it's all about critiquing how all these things dupe us. And
so let me unpack it. So basically, the Frankfurt School thought that capitalism could only keep going by virtue of the working class being constantly inundated with capitalist propaganda.
Yeah. See, that's so wrong.
But their theory of that was that actually that meant that the ceaseless capitalist propaganda had to take up the real discontents that people had in capitalism. In other words, it had to speak to them. It had to say, you know, this is the meaning of your life. In other words, it had to serve an enlightening function as well as a mystificatory function, because it could not mystify if it didn't also hold out some kind of enlightenment. In other words, they basically thought the workers were still bourgeois subjects who went to cultural forms and went to art seeking enlightenment and seeking reflection, seeking critical reflection on their condition, and that the capitalists had perfected a way of channeling discontent and that kind of search for enlightenment into this ersatz form. But that meant that it also was still there, right? So because obviously nobody gets together, not even in the Soviet Union, and says, okay, this is all the ways that we're going to control people through propaganda, through a film. No, it's made by artists who at an individual level, you know, produce something aesthetically that to them feels like a compelling description of reality and capturing all of its inner tensions and, you know, in a meaningful way, express the pathos of existence, right? So it's not like they were like, oh, this is just shit. I mean, actually, it's much more likely for these Stalinists like Gabriel Rockhill to just say, oh, Hollywood is just shit. Actually, the Frankfurt School took it a lot more seriously than that. So, but to say it's okay, it's moving away from moving away from political economy to culture, it's almost like the Stalinists will basically, they'll tell you, well, the workers should not like go see Hollywood movies or watch TV or listen to pop music. They should be doing like Pete Seeger folk music in their own like labor unions, right? And so that's where it's a kind of a funny thing where they would advocate a kind of counterculture of their own, ultimately. And so I think that, again, capitalism, it's not just an objective political economic system that people are exploited and oppressed by, and then the workers' culture is somehow over here to the side and exists in its own realm, right? And we can base the struggle on that. No, right? The capitalism is a total system. And it is a perversion of bourgeois culture and a perversion of bourgeois freedom, and also an expression of people's experience of unfreedom, right? That's true in political economy too. So the whole point, Marx's critique of political economy, to critique the workers' movement for socialism in the 19th century, like the labor unions and, you know, Chartism, this kind of movement, is to say, well, the workers are actually coming up against the limits of their own struggle in the society. They are, right? That contradiction is manifesting. Again, there was someone to read Marx's Kapital. In other words, Marx could be critiquing that movement and still think that he would find a hearing in that very movement, that they would sort of see how they were participating in something and coming up against the limits of it at the same time.
Right. I just want to throw in with you, Chris, quick, you know, Michael Parente, who the Midwestern Marxists love and I think Rock Hill loves, wrote a book called Inventing Reality, The Politics of the Mass Media. And in it, he accused the capitalists and the West of producing propaganda to mislead the workers and to misinform them. There's Noam Chomsky, who's hardly a Marxist, who wrote Manufacturing Consent. What's different about how you just described the Frankfurt School from them is that the Frankfurt School looked to the mass media and to mass culture and found the way in which it was critical.
Yes.
That's right. So, yes. And the limits of that kind of critique.
That's right.
Both. So right. They were themselves trying to think through their moment, which was inundated by media at that point. Right?
And by the way, we should just always recall that when they're writing in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s, I think that they were not expecting that in 2024, we would be struggling with the meaning of their work. In other words, they would have thought that we either would have overcome capitalism by now, or we would have gone so far into some kind of mindless barbarism that their work wouldn't make any sense whatsoever. And I guess I would say we're on that threshold, meaning when I look at the left's attack on the Frankfurt School, I'm like, yeah, they don't know what they're talking about at all. And it's in part because I guess the Frankfurt School's writing no longer makes any sense. So it has to be assimilated to these other kinds of concerns, you know, because I'm not just going to say, oh, like James Lindsay or Christopher Ruffo or Matt Taibbi also hates the Frankfurt School. You know, Marcuse, he blames Marcuse. I'm not going to say, okay, these guys are dumb. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to understand it. No, these are not stupid people. But there's a real problem trying to understand the point of this kind of thing. But I would say this is true of Marxism in general. So it's not like Marxism is going to, you know, touch grass. You know, it's not like Marxism is going to be concrete and real, whereas the Frankfurt School is in this kind of rarefied realm of culture. Mm-hmm. No, Marx is also, you know, far from like empirical reality, as far from empirical reality today as the Frankfurt School ever was.
I'm having my defend Matt Taibbi automatic response percolating.
You know what I mean, though? Taibbi attacked the Marcuse, right?
No, and I know he did.
And I feel like, you know, I'm not going to like crucify Matt Taibbi for that, but I kind of feel like, yeah, okay, you know, like, well, I'm like, you know, I'm also not going to defend Marcuse either, you know?
Yeah, it's like, well, yeah, Marcuse's, it was a repressive tolerance thing
right
that Taibbi was responding to, which I think was a mistake in Marcuse. I also think it's a lot to ask.
It's also misreading by Taibbi, too.
Totally. But it's a lot to ask a guy like Taibbi, who's written for Rolling Stone magazine and is a kind of a creative writer and journalist both, but who has not probably read capital or Greece or no.
You wouldn't necessarily want him to, because that might just like deform him beyond recognition. In other words, if he read too much like Marx, he may not be able to do like the Twitter files.
You know? Maybe. I think that you could do both. But I really do. I don't think that should prohibit people from doing Twitter files. But yeah, the point is, I wouldn't expect anyone to pick up one book by Marcuse or read it in a weekend and understand it.
Right.
That's the main point.
The main thing is the context is missing. The context is missing. And so instead, what you get is like a story. So the Gabriel Rockhill story is... Oh, the Frankfurt School is full of shit, and they were paid by the CIA. So,
whoa. Hey, let's address that. What's the deal with them being CIA?
Okay, but we have to go to the Patreon. We're 5 minutes past.
Sure. Yeah, let's do that.
Will we still get Chris? No, I think Chris will you still be with?
I'm gonna have to bail because I have.
Answer the CIA question then.
Answer the CIA question, and then we'll go.
Mm-hmm. I had.
Why were they paid by the CIA?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So obviously they were and they weren't, meaning Horkheimer, who held the purse strings for the Frankfurt School, made all the members of the Frankfurt School get jobs in the United States and in England, wherever they were. Right. So they had to earn their own way. And Marcuse went to work for the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner of the CIA. And he was part of the anti-Nazi struggle in World War II, like a lot of communists were, you know, the people who had to be purged after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they are in this milieu. They're in this, you know, communist party and also Trotskyist and also old style socialist milieu. They are in the left milieu. And they did a lot of things that other leftists did. Now, that's the... You know, is it what's his name? Cohn-Bendit, Danny Cohn-Bendit, Danny the Red. He denounced Marcuse for being a CIA operative, but it was for that. It was for being like a OSS employee during the war, in which, you know, he helped. He I always like to say he looked at a map of the Black Forest and he said, that little hut in the Black Forest, there's a Nazi who lives there. You have to bomb that one. That's Heidegger. No. So after the war, Horkheimer and Adorno go back to West Germany. So some people in the Frankfurt School and around the Frankfurt School go back to East Germany, like Brecht goes to East Germany. But they go to West Germany and they participate in denazification. And of course, you can't actually separate the U.S. and allied, you know, French and British occupation of West Germany's denazification program from their anti-communism, meaning obviously these things blend into each other as the Cold War emerges. So Adorno had a radio show on a station that was funded by the State Department and therefore, I guess, by the CIA. So there's a lot of, you know, I guess funding that is floating around after World War II and the Cold War period, where there's a lot of indirect funding of things like Partisan Review ended up getting some kind of CIA funding indirectly again. But, you know, and certainly the Partisan Review becomes very Cold War liberal, very anti-communist. It certainly does. And it becomes like, you know, a certain kind of a variety of neoconservatism. The Frankfurt School, no, right? So this is a kind of, you know, two steps removed, guilt by association. I would simply say this is just a slander. And now that leaves aside the question of their explicit politics. Their explicit politics, of course, they are anti-communist. In other words, they're anti-Stalinist. They definitely are anti-communist. So I was involved in unearthing and inspiring the translation and publication of Towards a New Manifesto, Horkheimer and Adorno, writing in 1956. In my book, I have an article on this. It's one of the first articles framing the entire book, Do We Need Adorno? that's about this 1956 discussion towards the New Manifesto, and they have some formulations that are tricky. They say that, of course, the East, the Russians are fascists. So red fascism, that's like a Cold War liberal, Cold War social democracy, Cold War anti-communist socialist kind of term, red fascism, which Habermas later called the students in the 60s, red fascists. So they said, the West represents the best that human civilization has ever been able to achieve, and the East, they are, the Russians are fascists. But they said, of course, the East is only what it is due to the oppression of imperialism, and that to try to defend the West would be the surest way of contributing to undermining the West. So they said, you know, we can't be on the side of the East, although we understand that the East is the way it is due to the continuation of capitalism and the pressure of imperialism. We do have to uphold the values that seem to be embodied in some way in the West, but the West can't be defended as such.
Right. All right.
Is that too dialectical?
You. No, that was very good. It seems very straightforward to me.
Right.
But we'll be talking about it more in the Parrot Room, where I'm expecting Ashley to really let me have it and defend those who would attack the Frankfurt School. Also, I'm going to talk and bitch and moan about Breonna Joy Gray in the Parrot Room. So join us there. Thanks again, Chris, for coming on. And
thanks. We'll. Thanks so much.
And people can see you every other Friday in the Control Zone.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Doug. See you, Ashley.
Thanks.
In the case of nuclear or radiological fallout, people living around the